Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Michael Whitman Show with your host, Michael Whitman, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Dr. Michael Whitman, and today we're at latalkradio.com. It's a cloudy day in LA. Hopefully we'll get more rain like we need it June 4th, and we are going to talk to Brian Teacher. I'm not only a clinical psychologist, I'm actually a sports psychologist as well. What does sports psychologists do, you may ask? A sports psychologist helps athletes generally with their problems and with their issues that are usually specific to being an athlete. The biggest one I would say is performance. Sports psychologists can help athletes maximize their performance by getting their mindset in a better place. So we do a lot of different exercises, and I have a background as a tennis player and a tennis coach before I became a psychologist. So I work with tennis players, but I also work with other athletes. And you try to help people find, you know, what works for them. And a lot of times it can be simple things, and sometimes other times I might want to go a little deeper and to see what's sort of inhibiting them from reaching their potential. Probably the biggest thing that I help junior athletes with is having fun, but with professional athletes, that can be huge too. And you can see a coach that knows how to get his players to have fun, or a sports psychologist that reminds them why they play the game. And when you have fun, you tend to perform your best. There's a whole science to it, and there's a lot of other aspects to maximizing performance than having fun. I did my dissertation working with junior tennis players, and there was an issue with one of them who always lost the third set, like 16 times in a row or something like that. Once he got into a third set, his game fell off and he would lose. And I had to kind of learn to take the pressure off, help him take the pressure off himself. So I said, well, okay, what's the difference then if you lost another one? You've already lost 16 times in a row. At this point, you know, there isn't any pressure. You know, even though you're feeling a ton, there's none because you're 0 for 16 lately. So sometimes it's just helping them with a mindset that eases the pressure and allows them to perform and enjoy. We're going to talk to Brian. Brian Teacher is calling in. And Brian was a professional tennis player in the late 70s and 80s and accomplished quite a bit, got to number 7 in the world, won the Australian Open, I believe, in 80 or 81. And was in very good company. The other Grand Slams that year were won by probably Borg, the French, and McEnroe, Wimbledon. Brian won the Australian, and McEnroe won the U.S. Open. So he's in the company of Borg and McEnroe, has wins over Connors and Ash, and doubles over McEnroe and Gerolaitis. And then he coached top players like Andre Agassi, a guy named Greg Ruzetsky, who he took from number 85 to number 4 in the world with his coaching. And he still coaches and helps out professional and amateur tennis players. He has a Brian Teacher Tennis Academy in Pasadena area. And we're going to hear a little bit about his story as well as his take on how to help athletes maximize from an emotional standpoint. So I'm going to see if I can unmute his call. Brian, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
I'm doing well. Thanks. It's great to have you on the show. And I just talked a little bit to the audience about, you know, a little bit of your background as a player and as a coach. But I wanted to maybe start with you before that so we could see how you arrived to certain achievements and what your support system was like. How did you get into tennis, and how did your family handle you as a competitive junior player to start with?
Okay, so I was born and raised in San Diego, and mm-hmm. I was 6 years old. I was already playing a little bit of tennis, and you know, and it was in the early 60s in San Diego, there was there weren't many tennis clubs. There was more public facilities, and there was kind of one public facility which was called Morley Field up in the Balboa Park area.
I know.
And it started out as 8 tennis courts, and that's where pretty much, you know, most of the city in the early 60s would go down. You know, people that were playing would play out of that public facility, and it got kind of popular. And I believe that's where Maureen Connolly, who was a Wimbledon champion, she grew up out of that public facility.
Huh.
And they started adding more courts, so more and more courts were added, and the facility just kept growing. I think ultimately it ended up having like 23 courts when I was 17, just that's the year I went to college in 72. But as far as, you know, growing up down there, it was a great place. It was where kind of everybody in the city kind of congregated to play. And I would go there. My mom would just drop me off after school, probably from the time I was, you know, 11 or 12. She wouldn't really, you know, it was those days you didn't have to supervise the kids, and they would...
Right.
They would just find games. We would just find games, and we would have one after another. There'd be kids all over the place to play with, and so it was a great place to grow up playing. My mom was really the one that supported me in the tennis. My father didn't really want me to play at all. He didn't think much was going to happen, and, you know, it's like spend more time studying and doing that than playing the sport.
Oh, he wasn't
and
athletic.
So, pardon?
He wasn't athletic himself then?
Maybe as a kid or something, he boxed a little bit, but, you know, by the time he got to college, he wasn't into athletics at all, and it was more, you know, he wanted me just to get good focus on getting good grades and get a good education, and then, you know.
What was his career, if you don't mind?
He was an attorney. He was an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought the schooling was way more important, which it is important, but there's always a sense of balance. So anyway, so he, even when I ended up, you know, I came up through the ranks and, you know, the age groups, and I was always passionate about playing and wanted to play more. It was a fun sport. A lot of my friends were playing, you know, like baseball, softball, those type of team sports. And they didn't, you know, I tried to play them a little bit. They didn't seem like a lot of fun because you weren't getting much action in the team sport. You know, you'd have to, if you were playing left field or whatever, you'd have to wait for the ball to come out in your area before you get a play at it. And then, right. You know, it's up at bat. How many times you get up at bat? Whereas tennis, you're constantly moving, constantly. It's about you and how you're performing. So I was attracted to the one-on-one, you know, competition.
So it sounds like there were a lot of just people hanging around that you could get games with. Your mom would drop you off. Were there a lot of lessons when you were a junior, or is it more just hit against the backboard and other people? Or?
Well, she started me off. She was kind of just like a local, you know, kind of like, you know, she'd play like 4 or 5 days a week with her friends. And so she started like kind of pitching me balls and bringing a you know, bucket of balls out and started hitting me balls. And then I started getting a few lessons and so just local lessons at the park. And, I would kind of graduate from, you know, from the local guy at the park to other instructors in San Diego. But,
right.
You know, there was no real professional tennis in those days. I mean, tennis was an amateur sport and, all the Grand Slams were amateur. There was like a start of a professional, circuit, small circuit of like 8 players or something, but it wasn't, you know, and there was really not much tennis on TV. So you kind of really had to learn on the fly from the local instructors and
so I get a better sense of your,
pardon?
I get a better sense of your dad's position. He figured, why pour your hours into doing something that's not going to be a way to make a living? You might be an excellent tennis player, but it might be like being good at pickup basketball. It's just not going to pay off for your life.
And it was never something that I, no, it wasn't, tennis was never something that I thought I would make a living at. It was more just I was passionate about playing. It was just always fun for me.
Right.
You know, it kept me busy. It was fun. I kind of, you know, I started to get decent at it and develop my, you know, part of my identity from the sport.
Right.
And it certainly was a healthy sport. Teaches you, you know, all sports are about sportsmanship and competing and learning how to lose and learning how to win and get better, right? You learn your lessons. You actually get better when you lose, right? Because you got to figure out how to improve yourself and move yourself forward. Is it the technique? Is it the mental aspect? Or is it both that's holding you back?
I agree. And yeah, you deal, as a kids who get into sports early, you can often tell that they've had some coping skills that they got to develop that other people may not have had that chance of, how to lose, like you said, and deal with disappointment, even deal with being injured, cheated. A lot gets thrown your way as even a young athlete, right?
Yeah, you're dealing with it. You know, you're playing tournaments. You're in practice. It's the same thing. You know, yeah. You know, even in practice, you know, you're trying to play hard, and a little your buddy's cheating you, or your somebody's right. cheating you, and then it happens in a tournament, and then you know you feel the world is against you, the referee's calling against you, and you know, right. so you got to deal with all that stress and adversity, and then you know you think you're playing well, and then there's somebody that's better than you and just hands you your lunch, and you know, and you get killed, and you say, you know, all of a sudden you think you stink and you suck, and you go back to the drawing board. Do I want to go through this again? And
did you have a bad temper, throw rackets, anything like that, or what was your temperament like as a teen and stuff like that?
You know, I mean, I think probably as a teenager I kind of had a little bit of a temper.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get kind of pissed off, and sometimes, you know, I'd throw my racket and stuff, and mm-hmm. of course I wouldn't do that if my mom was watching me, but sometimes, you know, we'd lose our temper, and even in college and stuff, and you know, you learn, you have to learn that kind of holds you back a little bit.
Yeah.
And you start changing. I mean, I think it's okay to, you know, have an outburst here or there, but obviously if you're holding on to your anger and frustration, then you know, you're losing the moment of the next point, and you know, you're going to goof yourself up that mentally you're not prepared and alert to respond to what's happening, you know, in the next second, right?
All right.
You got to let it go pretty quick, and you know,
you got to let go of mistakes.
You got to learn to breathe and relax and just mm-hmm. kind of, you know, refocus. That's what it is, and you know, I think it's the same with just about any athlete in sports. You know, you got to be able to always refocus and mm-hmm. what's the task that you're trying to accomplish here, and what are you trying to do?
Right, and we'll get into more of sort of the nuts and bolts of how you help your athletes today, because I know you coach and how you help them with the mental aspect, because tennis is, of course, a very mental game. We'll get into that. So I wanted to know, how did then you go, you know, where did you go to college, and how did you continue your development? Did you graduate and all that good stuff?
Okay, so, you know, I was really, by the time I was 17, I was a year ahead of myself in high school. So I graduated high school at 17, mm-hmm. and I got a college scholarship to UCLA, and I was really excited. That was really the only place I wanted to go. I was kind of Jimmy Connors was there a couple years before mm-hmm. I was, and so was another NCAA champion, Jeff Broviak and Haroon Rahim, two great college players that ended up, you know, being top 20 players in the world in singles.
Mm-hmm.
So they always had fantastic teams at UCLA. Arthur Ashe was there before those guys. And so I just, you know, it was all California, and I was a California kid, and that's what I wanted to stay in California, and UCLA was my first choice and my only choice, really. So I was lucky enough to get a scholarship there. And I was excited, you know, like crazy to get out of San Diego. And mm-hmm. it was a completely different environment. You know, it was much more... It was a higher level of competition, right? I'm a freshman. I'm coming in, you know, with the seniors and juniors, and these guys are top players collegiately in the country. And so it pushed me a lot. It pushed me, and I enjoyed being pushed and enjoyed the challenge of trying to figure out and always trying to figure out, what do I need to get better? You know, why is my stroke, you know, what am I doing wrong here? And how do I improve this stroke? And how do I get a little tougher and all that? So that's what it was all about.
Right. It sounds like, you know, it could be a tough transition for somebody who had probably a dominant junior career to be a, you know, kind of a small fish in a big pond in a way in the college transition relative to where you were. But you liked the challenge of trying to figure out, how can I get better, and didn't take it as, you know, I'm not – your ego seems like it didn't get in your way with some of this stuff.
No, I loved the challenge.
Yeah.
It was like exciting. It was exciting for me. You know, it was exciting to play with better players and to always be, you know, trying to get better. And I didn't mind getting beat. It was mm-hmm. always about, when I got beat, well, how can I, you know, what's letting me down? What do I need to do to get better? What shot or what aspect of my game? And always trying to figure that out and learn something new.
Right, right. It sounds like you had a good attitude from a pretty early age. So
even though I'd get pissed off.
I could see that.
And that would get in the way. But overall, that was the general feeling. Yeah, it's always trying to figure out how to get better.
Well, I don't know if you know Alan Fox. He writes about some sports psychology books specifically to tennis, and how it's unique. And there's so many opportunities for frustration and not closing a set, a game, a match.
Yeah.
You know, it's just sort of rife with opportunity for frustration. So I can
see. It sure is.
If you had an outburst occasionally, I think it's probably not a big deal either. So with UCLA, what did you study, and did you graduate, and what was you know?
So I ended up 4 years at UCLA. My second year, I won the Pac-8 singles and doubles as a sophomore, and there was only eight schools in the Pac-8, and mm-hmm. so that was kind of the toughest section by far in the country. So I was seeded one going to the NCAAs, and right after that tournament, I started having really bad back issue.
Hmm.
And so I was 19, and it was like, oh man, something's seriously wrong with my back.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I started having to get into doing a lot of yoga and figuring out. They said that they thought I might need, that I had a congenital issue with my spine and I might need surgery.
Hmm.
So I started doing a lot of yoga, and it seemed to help. But the main thing was that at that time, that was the first indication. That was like in 70. So 72, 73 was my freshman, 73, 74. Was my sophomore year, and so tennis in 1968, the first open Grand Slam was the Forest Hills U.S. Open, and Arthur Ashe beat Tom Archer, I think it was in four sets, and he won $14,000 for winning it.
Wow.
So that was, you know, and so open had been going on for, you know, probably, you know, 4 or 5 years at that time, open tennis, and so it was like when I was like, all of a sudden I won the Pac-8, my sophomore year, I thought, you know what, maybe when I'm done with school, I'll try to play professionally and see how I do. That was the first time I thought, maybe I'll try this, you know, and see. So I had never thought about it ever before then.
Interesting.
And so, you know, it was never, you know, today a lot of kids dream of being, you know, number one, or dream of being
did.
A top
yeah.
player.
Mm-hmm.
But it never, because I guess it wasn't on TV or anything, so we didn't have really anything to emulate or to go by at that time. And it wasn't really until kind of I got to college and I started seeing, you know, the better players, and then I was around, you know, LA had, it was like a big hub of tennis. It had a lot of professional players. I mean, Connors was always playing tennis around here, and mm-hmm. he was already like, you know, I think in 74, 75, he was certainly in the top four or five players in the world already.
Yeah.
So he was practicing around. Once in a while, I'd get to practice with him. And that, you know, it was always like, you know, and it was inspiring to be able to play with these guys and see, you know, see how good they were and try to emulate stuff that you thought that they would, the better things that you thought they did that you could copy, right?
Yeah.
So that's really like, you know, it's like, what are the ingredients that these top guys do? And you try to figure out the top, you know, the essential ingredients and say, well, I need to do that because I definitely don't do that.
Uh-huh. It sounds like you were in a great environment to keep improving.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. It was a terrific environment, you know. And later when I went professionally, I mean, at that time in the, you know, the mid late 70s, we had like in the US, we had like, I don't know, at least 40 Americans were in the top 100 players in the world.
That's awesome.
And now, you know, you're lucky if you have
five.
I don't know, four maybe. I don't know if it's four or five players, you know. So a lot of those players were, there was probably, you know, there's probably 15, 20 professional players in LA that were, you know, in the top 150.
So you guys just kind of like reminds me of the Spaniards a little bit in the last 10 years. You guys just kept getting better by playing with each other on a daily basis. You could say Connors want to play a set, or I don't remember who else was around then, but so-and-so you want to play doubles, and all of a sudden you got better that day.
Yeah, it was just, there was a lot of good tennis to practice with and improve with the whole way up. So that's why I kind of relocated up in LA after mm-hmm. after school, because there was no place else that I knew other than going to Florida, which I didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I just stayed in LA.
I don't think I ever told you this, Brian, but my first coach when I was a little peewee 5-year-old was Whitlinger, John Whitlinger. Isn't that funny?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
John, I'm sure you know him.
Sure, we grew up the same year in
college, right?
In college,
right.
And actually, the year I was seeded one at the NCAAs was the year he won the NCAAs that year. He won it, I think. He might have won the NCAAs two years. I'm not sure.
I think he definitely
won it that year, but I'm not sure. But he definitely won it that year.
Yeah. So, okay, you had a lot of good environment, it sounds like, and as well as I like that somehow you had a very good focus on self-development, improvement, and didn't get too hung up on setbacks. And I think that probably helped you keep improving, and the goal, you know, wasn't just results. It just seemed like you were really interested in improving your game.
I mean, as a coach today, you know, I look at, you know, kids that are anywhere from, you know, 13 to 18 or whatever in that range, and I think probably to me, what I see is one of the most discouraging things for a kid is when they have developed, you know, bad technique, and that technique that basically they've been playing, you know, the game for whatever it is, 5, 8, 10 years, and their technique is so cemented in their, you know, in their muscle memory, mm-hmm. that, and it's so bad that it's so limiting in their shot making and what they can do, that they get to a level and they don't really know how to improve anymore, or if they even can, and so they get stuck and they start falling backwards, because it becomes, it, all of a sudden when you keep losing, it doesn't become, it's not fun anymore, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden you used to win, maybe you were a big strong kid and you didn't have good technique, but then all of a sudden, like all the kids that you were bigger and stronger of, now they've gotten to be big and strong, and now all of a sudden you're right in the pack, but you still have bad technique and you start losing, and then next thing you know,
it's
not
spot.
Fun for you anymore, and you get frustrated and you end up quitting because you can't figure out how to get better. Most of the time it's the technique that is holding back. At least that's what I've seen. I mean, yeah, you do see kids with mental blocks and that have trouble with losing and picking themselves up, and they're either too much of a perfectionist or too much of a prima donna, or they're just, for whatever reason, they're just too hard on themselves emotionally. Maybe their parents are, and maybe that's rubbed off on them. But most of the time, it's their technique that frustrates them, that they can't be free with their technique and get the most out of the shot, that they're limited either with, you know, with control or spin, or they lack power.
I wondered about what you thought about, like, Richard Williams sort of having the foresight to keep his kids out of junior tennis so they wouldn't burn out or get frustrated and just keep developing their games and confidence. What do you think about a parent taking that approach and a parent coach? What do you think about those ideas?
It rarely works, parent coach, but in their case, it did. It does sometimes work, and for them, as far as keeping them out of junior tennis, I mean, it's like it typically does not work. It typically, but you know, in the Williams girls, you had two of the premier women athletes, I think, in the world. I mean, those girls could have played any sport and excelled, mm-hmm. really. I mean, they were phenomenal athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And so with those girls, it wasn't the norm, you know, that basically they would have excelled at any sport. And so I think they were able to circumvent the junior tour and not do it. But I will tell you that just working with I work with a little English boy here that just his parents were over on a visa for, they were horse trainers here at Santa Anita. Mm-hmm. So I worked with him from when he was 11 until 17. He just went back to England, is now working under the British Lawn Tennis, and they're helping him out some. So he was not allowed to play in the top tier junior tournaments in his age group. So I guess in Southern Cal they have like a level one, which is where all the top kids have to play. If you're a top ranked kid in that, mm-hmm. you have to play in that. And if you're, and then it goes down like level one to maybe level like 4 and 5 levels, which is the 5 level, obviously, is the lowest level of that age group, right? And so he was never allowed to play in the level one or the level two because the sectional, the Southern Cal sectional, basically said, well, these kids that are playing, we can't allow somebody who's not, you know, doesn't have a green card and doesn't, you know, committed full time here, because that will affect the other kids' rankings that are trying to get into the nationals. And so he was not allowed to play those. So he always had to play level 3, 4, and 5. So he never got to play the top kids. And there's no question. So finally, it just got to a point where he, you know, he's winning these tournaments. He'd win a couple tournaments and just no competition because he needs to go to the next level and can't. And it was like, look, I said, Ryan Story was his name. I said, Ryan, if you don't start playing the International Tennis Federation, which is kind of the global circuit for kids that want to play internationally, if you don't start playing that, because that will allow you to play the top kids around the world.
Right.
If you don't start playing that, you're lost. You might as well stop, because you're not going to go anywhere unless you keep pushing yourself and stepping out and trying to find out where you are in competition and keep trying to improve.
And I suppose
you have to keep pushing yourself.
With the Williams sisters, they did have each other as phenomenal competitors and practice partners. And
yes, they did. But what I'm saying is the norm is for, like, this kid, he's now playing international and he's doing better, but he's still finding his footing a year later. And he's improved. I think right now he's ranked 130 in the world in the 18 in numbers.
Uh-huh.
But he never plays quite as well in practice as he does when he's competing. He hasn't quite figured out, you know, the transition yet. So he always feels like he's holding back or he goes for too much, you know. And mm-hmm. so the Williams girls got away with it because, like I said, they were at the time when they came up, look, they're both, you know, big, strong girls, athletes, right? And
right.
they were probably both the fastest and strongest women on the tour when they came out
right.
at that age. And now you're seeing a lot more Eastern European women that are big and strong, that are like, you know, 6'1", 6'2", and they're strong and fast. You didn't see those. I mean, if you look back 30, 40 years ago, the women were not 6 foot plus
and
super athletic yeah. like they are today. They just weren't.
Yeah, I remember there was a lot more soft hitting, and it was Hingis and, you know, Graf was good,
yeah, well,
but she chipped.
Hingis is, uh-huh. I mean, Hingis was kind of that last generation
right.
before it moved into the, as Mary Carrillo would say, the big babe tennis. Right.
Right.
That's her statement, right? So,
okay.
you know, it kind of transitioned at that point. Yeah. I mean, Martina Hingis would struggle today to be in, I think, in the top 20 in singles if she
right.
was playing today.
But yeah, I maybe this is a side point, but I miss a little bit of the non-power tennis where people did have to work things more, like a Hingis, or in your generation, the 80s, like a Borg or Connors, where it wasn't
yeah.
just slam serve, slam forehand, and you know, it's gotten very monotonous. And the personalities when you played Borg, McEnroe, Connors, Nastasi, you know, were so different than now, too, I think, not just the game. I think it was an unusual era of tennis that you were in, too.
Well, yeah, it was. You had some genuine animosities that, in some cases, still exist today between those guys. I mean, they never, you know, Connors, Lendl, McEnroe,
right.
you know, they always were very feisty to each other on the court, you know, and the last thing they wanted to do was lose to each other, so... You know,
right.
those things persisted for well into even after they retired, I think. You know, maybe today they talk to each other.
Right.
But still.
And
know,
so like, let's try to look at, if you don't mind, I know you're not very into going over your achievements, but I want to make you try to understand how mentally, because, you know, I'm a sports psychologist, things came together for you and you won a Grand Slam amongst, you know, those guys. And I don't know if you heard me, but that year, was it 80 or 81 when you won the Australian Open?
That was when the Australian Open started over the December holidays of Christmas, and then it went into the New Year. So it actually started in 80 and ended in 81.
Oh, I see. So you won the finals in 81.
It has since changed to be like, you know, the middle of January.
So in that time, in 81, I was telling the listeners, the Grand Slam champions of the French were like Borg, and then McEnroe won Wimbledon and the U.S. Open, and then Teacher, Australian Open. So you're in very
yeah,
good company.
Name out of, that doesn't seem like it quite drives with those other names. No.
You're being humble. You got to seven in the world. You were in their company. But how did, in that tournament, things, you know, seem to peak for you?
Yeah, I did. Well, I was playing, I was playing great tennis up through the fall. You know, I think I'd gotten to like four finals, you know, in the ATP tournament, in the tour leading up to there was like I was in Hong Kong in the finals, and
mm-hmm.
I had Lendl. I think Lendl was still young, 19 or 20 at the time, and he was already in the top 10, but moving up. And I had him. I was up a set and 4-2 in the second, 15-40 on his serve for a double break point. I ended up, you know, to go up serving 5-2 for the match, and I lost that game and ended up losing the match in three sets, close three sets. So that was kind of discouraging, but I was playing really well. And then mm-hmm. I think the next week,
are you still discouraged about that
like
loss?
Three times in a row, and then when I went down to Australia, I lost in the finals of the warm up in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
I lost 7-6 in the third. I had match points against an American tennis player, Fritz Buning, who was from UCLA, big, strong, like, kid that was 6'5", 6'6", very athletic. And then, so I had match points, so I was playing really good. So, and grass I enjoyed playing on, so which the surface of the Australian Open was at that time.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was on grass mm-hmm. up until, wow, until this new venue's come out. I don't even know the exact year it was. I
mean, and you were a serve and volleyer, so it suited your style?
Yeah, it suited. I mean, I like playing on grass, mm-hmm. and it suited my style. So, mm-hmm. you know, I found myself into the quarterfinals and said, you know what, I got as good a chance as anybody in this tournament, and just, you know, take it, you know, one match, one point at a time, and just see what happens. And mm-hmm. I just kept winning the matches and just kept trying to pump myself up positively, you know, thinking that I had a chance to do this, but obviously you had to perform.
Right.
And so just trying to stay in the present with performing.
Well, I did a little homework on you, and I read in a book that you almost didn't play that Australian Open because of personal, physical stuff.
Yeah, no, yeah, it was a personal issue thing that, you know. So I'd actually pulled out of the tournament,
uh-huh.
and I told the tournament director it was actually a personal issue, but I told him I had a back issue after the finals of the previous tournament,
uh-huh.
and I had my bags packed. And had a plane to catch, and I pulled out of the tournament, and I had a change of heart, and I called up the tournament director just before I was ready to get into a taxi cab to go to the airport, and told him, I said, you know what, I feel like my back is better. I told him my back was bad and it was better, and he said, look, I'll put you back in, but you can't breathe a word of this to anybody, because really, you know, on the list of lucky losers, you're not supposed to be back in. It's supposed to be the person who was the last one who lost in the qualifying. So anyway, right. I was lucky he put me back in, and the rest is history. I just lucked out there.
Well, it sounds like it was meant to be. Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Cool. And I did a little more homework, and your best wins were over Connors and Ash, I think, right?
I beat Lendl.
And Lendl.
I ended up beating Lendl, a couple weeks later when I lost. I beat him in Bangkok.
And then I saw a doubles win over McEnroe and Gerolaitis. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't look at doubles as my best win, but, I mean, tennis was interesting in those years. I mean, there was not a lot of prize money, so I got to be five in the world in doubles. I'd won six tournaments. I think it was in 83, somewhere in that vicinity. And I won six tournaments, but each tournament we'd split like $9,000, and it was like,
oh wow,
man, I'm doing really well in doubles. I feel like I'm a better doubles player than singles player.
I would think
but
so.
I'm doing well in singles, and there's more money in singles. And if you play doubles, like it's like, you know, you play your singles match, and then you wait around all day to play doubles. And sometimes, even if it's an indoor event, you might not get on till 12 o'clock at night, and then you might have to play at 11 or 12 the next day, and it's just like wearing you out. So I just decided to quit because there was no money in it.
Right.
And and so I did quit, and eventually, as we see, the prize money started coming up quite a bit. But the prize money in general started coming up towards the end of the end of the 80s. I mean, I think they increased the prize money all of a sudden like 300 to 500%. And so, you know, both in singles and doubles, the prize money went way, way, way up. And then people were really able to start, you know, making a living from playing doubles.
So let me ask you this, because I've worked with some athletes on this, where you do a sport your whole career, and you have a lot of accolades oftentimes if you're a pro. What was the transition like from being off the tour and into the sort of real world after sort of a star athlete career?
You know, I think, you know, for me, it was like after traveling around so much, you know, and traveling around the world and kind of the excitement of tennis, you know, I thought about, you know, should I get my MBA? What should I do? And I went back to a business school at SC. I went for a year trying to get my MBA. I mean, I did fine grade-wise, but I ended up dropping out after a year because it was just, I just couldn't see myself working for a corporation, mm-hmm. or what I was going to do with my degree. And I think it was probably a mistake at the time not to finish, but, you know, at this point in my life, I don't have any regrets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just trying to, you know, unless you stay somehow in the sport or do something, which I coached, you know, I coached professionally for a while, so I did that. And,
I told the listeners that you coached Agassi and Rudzetsky and had
I coached a bunch of guys. I coached like five guys that were playing singles that mm-hmm. were pretty good doubles player. Five guys that were number one in the world in doubles. It was Grab and Rennenberg.
I remember those guys.
Max Mirny, actually Daniel Nestor, who's still playing on the tour, is one of the top doubles players. He's like in his 40s.
He's my age.
And then Mark Knowles was playing with him. He was also, so those guys were five, and you know, they were five number ones in the world that I was coaching in doubles.
I didn't know that. Cool.
And so, yeah, I worked with a bunch of different guys traveling for a while, and it gets old living out of the suitcase traveling. You do it so much, you get used to it, but it kind of gets like, oh, man, it's like too much wasted time and away from your family, and it's just like, why do you want to do this anymore?
So, right. You know. So, you know, if you had, you know, I think you do have grown kids, but if you had a, you know, young kid today.
Girls, yeah.
What would be your parenting style if they showed an interest in tennis, or did your girls show an interest in tennis? How did that play out?
My kids didn't really show an interest, and I did teach my girls how to throw a ball athletically, you know. Mm-hmm. I think even one of the things I see as a coach today is a lot of girls can't throw a ball, you know. And so, I mean, it's hard to teach them to serve if they can't throw a ball.
I see.
And if you look at the girls' tour, I mean, you got Serena, whose serve stands way out in front of anybody, and then you got the pack, who basically don't even compare serving wise.
Right.
So, you know, it's important to learn how to throw a ball. But my kids, you know, they gravitated more towards team sport, towards volleyball, and all you can do is try to encourage them. You can't force them to do it. They either like it or they don't. Right. And
right.
So, it didn't click for them, but they learned how to hit the ball and learn how to play, and hopefully, you know, they can come back to it anytime they want and just get into it.
Right.
It's. I think it. You know, all you can do is introduce it and see if there's some passion for it. You can't to force it to them. They'll end up hating it. So you don't want to do that.
Well, you know, because I'm a psychologist and people bring their kids in. I. You've probably seen this trend as a coach. There seems to be in our culture a little bit of, I wouldn't call it delusional, but maybe some delusions of grandeur parents have for their kids now. And I would guess as a coach that might spill off into them over-evaluating their kids' potential. Do you ever...
Are you trying to tell me politely that some parents are nuts?
Well,
I mean, come on. Yeah, some parents are nuts. They have delusions of grandeur. You know, they don't know what they're talking about, and, you know, they have no clue at all, and they're putting pressure on their kids, and it can be a very unhealthy, you know, unhealthy situation, basically. So,
I know... You've referred me some of your tennis players. Is there a way in which you ever sit down with parents and say, you know, I think you need to back off a little or make it more fun or talk about some of that, you know? Because when I played the junior circuit and national juniors, and so I saw a lot of out-of-control parents. You know, it was even to the point of abuse, you know, out in the open. So... Do you ever have to say, you know, we need to have a talk, or this is too much? Let me do the coaching. You kind of just, you know, be encouraging. Do you ever have those talks, or you just leave that to
once
me?
Once in a while, I have a student where the dad, you know, sometimes will, you know, comment too much on the lesson and try to get the kid to listen. So, you know, I have to ask him to please back off a little bit and just let me do it while I'm here, because it kind of irritates the kid when his dad, you know, saying that to him. So, you know, yeah. So, but not very often. I mean, I think the dad's heart's in the right spot. And
your dad stayed out of it. Maybe that was good in a way that he wasn't into it.
You know, probably not. I mean, he wanted me to still quit playing in college, so I kind of felt like, you know, that I was supposed to fail at this, really, that I wasn't supposed to do it. It's kind of what my instincts felt like, so I had a lot to overcome. I mean, he really never supported it until I was a successful pro, so it was a little bit hard that way.
Okay, I didn't know that. Well, we have about 8 minutes left, so... I wanted to talk to you about the current game, and me and you were talking, actually, before the French Open, we talked about Nadal's seeding, which jumped out at me, and then he actually played to his seeding, and what do you think about where he's at, both as a tennis player and maybe a guy who's used to being on top, but certainly on clay?
Well, I'm sure that he's struggling for answers. He might even know some of them, what's going on. I mean, he's had a bunch of, you know, over the years of physical things. You know, if you've watched him play at, you know, and enjoyed him like I have at his highest level, and I'm sure millions of people have. You've seen how physical he is when he's feeling good. I mean, he just like is like has so much energy and is so strong physically when he runs to the ball. But you also see the difference between how he runs the ball and how he hits the ball versus a guy like Federer and Djokovic. I mean, they're just so light when they move, and they're so fluid. Not that Federer, not that Nadal is not fluid, but he just looks like he uses twice the energy as these other guys do, because he generates so much torque through the ball.
And
you just see how much energy he's expending to hit the ball, and it's almost like hard to believe he can do it for, you know, for five sets, but then he does it for five sets and does five more, and it's like endless and endless. And it looks to me, you know, like if you look at his body, and it, certainly from what I've seen, that, yeah, this is the guy that's going to wear his body out over the long haul, because how can he keep doing it? Nobody can do that eventually for that long. And so it's not surprising that, you know, he has more injuries and that he's struggling a little bit more with his body at his age.
Well, it makes me think the opposite of him is somebody like McEnroe, who's still able to play pretty well, quite well for his age. And part of that maybe is, like you're saying, is not much effort expended, very smooth.
Yeah, I mean, John has incredible, McEnroe has incredible balance. And is very light on his feet. Even he's like 55, 56. I mean, he's incredibly light on his feet.
Right.
And everything's very economical. But, you know, John was brought up with a different, completely strokes and mindset. The equipment was different. So the whole loading and unloading. But, I mean, for the time and the equipment, which was wooden rackets at the time John learned to play, I mean, he's pretty efficient with his body and what he does and how he controls it. And so that's pretty much was his game even today. You know, how he adapted to the wooden racket is still in his game today. Of course, his style and his loading and unloading is good, but it's so much more economical than any of the tour players today. But, you know, when you get into your mid-40s and 50s, you can't possibly run or load like these kids do and hit the ball, because they're just putting so much energy and legs and hips into the ball. It's impossible as you get older to do that.
Right. And so, you know, I can hear in your voice, it sounds like you still have that passion for the game that you had as a kid, that you really are still fascinated by the whole game of tennis. Am I getting that right? That you're still just,
well, yeah, I mean,
something
I
you love.
Yeah, I love to watch a good match. There's no question about it. It's fun to watch great tennis, and it's fun to watch them load and hit, and how athletic and artistic they are, and with the shots. And I mean, how much longer are we going to be able to see Roger out there? I don't really care if he doesn't win a slam. I'm sure he would like to win one, but it's still so much fun to watch the guy play.
It is.
And just admire what he does out there and how graceful he is. It's incredible.
Well, I was fortunate to have the ATP in Cincinnati come to my town when I was a kid, and it was before all the security got, you know, so heavy. So there'd be top pros, you know, running around.
So what year was that? Because I played that tournament almost every year.
Well, I remember you. So
where was the event held that year when you were there? Because it was many places.
Jack Nicklaus Sports Center in Mason.
Oh, okay. Isn't that where it is?
It's still there. Yeah.
So you weren't there before. It moved around about four other venues before it ended up there.
Right. I wasn't there before. I was there when it just started, Jack Nicklaus, and the players' clubhouse or changing room was at the golf clubhouse. So the players had to walk a couple hundred yards to the tennis courts. So that was a chance for an 8 to 12 year old boy like me to get pictures and autographs, and it was a big thrill. So I got to see. I never got to see Borg. I remember that, but I got to meet the other people like McEnroe and Becker and Lendl and people like that. And I remembered you. And although when I was real little, I couldn't tell teacher from Telcher apart, but then as I got a little older, I could. So
it's quite an event today. I mean, they got a permanent, you know, beautiful facility, and they've incorporated the women's tournament in with the men's, and it's I think it's probably like a 10-day event now, and it's pretty amazing. Yeah.
So okay, we've covered a lot of ground. I'm going to look through my cheat sheet and see if there's anything else I wanted to touch upon. Okay, one more thing. How do you help, and this is related to confidence, and you were talking about Nadal's torque on his body, but how do you help a player coming back from injuries and all of a sudden things don't quite feel right? I know you talked about you had back issues, and I know you've had a hip issues as a after your career, I think more. But what do you, how do you help athletes with injuries and their game and their mindset?
Well, I had like torn ligaments. I did it once in U.S. Open in '79. I think I was out for like 7 months. I snapped my ankle so bad that it was like dangling, and so I was literally off of the tour for like 7-8 months. And you know, it's hard. You just, and at that time they had no ranking protection, so you just lost all the points and you had to start pretty much from the bottom again. So yeah, it's not easy. You have to just get back to, you know, feeling healthy, you know, and that takes time and and a lot of patience and a lot of practice and just sticking with it day in and day out. I had really no idea, even when I tore those ligaments that bad, that because I went to Dr. Job, who was the Dodgers doctor at the time. He did the Tommy John surgery.
Yeah, I remember Job.
On his elbow. Yeah, and he said, you know, he said, normally I'd sew somebody like you back up together, sew the ligaments back, but there's nothing to sew back. So it was like I didn't really know at what level, you know, if they were going to heal. I was probably too naive to think that, oh, you know, maybe this isn't going to be right. But I remember when I got my cast off, I just, like, cried because my leg looked so bad and I couldn't even come close to walking.
Wow.
That was a time where you couldn't take the cast off and you had to leave it on. And, you know, it was just, like, atrophied and it was all black and stuff, black and blue. Anyway, so, you know, it's just day in and day out of just trying to, you know, you just got to be patient and give yourself time and just keep pushing ahead and stay focused. You know, it's hard because you get more doubts in your head, obviously, when you're bouncing back from that. You know, can I get my form back? Can I this? And you just keep trying and scrapping at it, and day at a time, and you just stay focused and see if you can get it back. If that's your passion, that's what you love to do, you'll try to get it back. If it's not your passion and you don't love it, well, it's impossible.
yeah, I hear you. Well, it was a lot of fun having you on the show and talking tennis, talking sports psychology, and getting a little bit of your background. So appreciate it. And
thank you for having me, Michael.
All right, Brian. Have a great day. And all you listeners, that was the Dr. Michael Whitman Show, talking sports psychology with Brian Teacher.
Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.